From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, lawyer Brian Stevenson, a leader in the fight against racial injustice. The new film, Just Mercy, is based on his memoir. He's also created a memorial and museum dedicated to confronting America's racist history. He studied how other countries have dealt with their past atrocities.
There are no Adolf Hitler statues in Germany, but in this country, we don't talk about slavery. We don't talk about the Native genocide. In the American South where I live, the landscape is littered with the iconography of the Confederacy.
Also, Justin Chang reviews the film drama The Assistant, inspired by the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. And we hear from singer-songwriter Amy Rigby.
At night we pass out before 10. Are we ever gonna have sex again?
Rigby has a new memoir. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the leaders in the fight against racial injustice within the justice system, Brian Stevenson. His memoir, Just Mercy, was adapted into the new film of the same name, starring Michael B. Jordan as Stevenson and Jamie Foxx as the man on death row whose case Stevenson is appealing. Stevenson is the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, which provides legal representation to people who've been illegally convicted, unfairly sentenced, or abused in state jails and prisons. Stevenson and his staff have won reversals, relief, or release for over 135 wrongly condemned prisoners on death row, and won relief for hundreds of others who were wrongly convicted or unfairly sentenced. While continuing to work within the justice system, Stevenson has also started working outside the courts, trying to get people to better understand the racist aspects of American history. Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative founded the Legacy Museum, which dramatizes racial injustice from enslavement to mass incarceration, and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, dedicated to the memory of enslaved people and African Americans terrorized by lynching, humiliated by racial segregation and Jim Crow, and people of color burdened with contemporary presumptions of guilt and police violence. The museum, the memorial, and the Equal Justice Initiative are in Montgomery, Alabama. Brian Stevenson, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've said you wanted to start the museum and the memorial because you started to notice a new resistance to civil rights in the state and federal courts, and you started to notice this about a decade ago. What was the change you were noticing?
Well, I'm a product of Brown versus Board of Education. I grew up in a community where black children weren't allowed to go to the public school. There were no high schools for black kids. When my dad was a teenager, he couldn't go to high school in our county. And I remember how lawyers came into our community and made them open up the public schools, and that's what created the opportunities for me to go to high school, to go to college, to go to law school. And the law had the power to achieve justice and opportunity that wasn't possible otherwise. That's why I wanted to be a lawyer, that's why I went to law school, and I still believe in the power of the law to help disfavored people, to help people who have been marginalized, to help people who will never have the political power to achieve the basic rights that they deserve through a political process. And, I spent 20-some years in the courts advocating for people. I didn't really want a lot of publicity. I didn't think that was helpful to the clients I was trying to serve. But it was about a decade ago that I began to worry that we weren't going to achieve the kind of change, the kind of reform, the kind of justice that I think is desperately needed in this country if we stayed in the courts alone.
So how did you think a museum and a memorial that looked at the history of slavery and what happened after Reconstruction and the lynchings and segregation, how did you think that would help create more equal justice in the U.S.?
Well, I just felt like we had to introduce a narrative about American history that wasn't clearly being articulated. I think we are a post-genocide society. Think what happened to Native people when Europeans came to this continent was a genocide. We killed millions of Native people through famine and war and disease. Then we justified that violence by creating a narrative of racial difference. We said that Native people are savages, and we use that rhetoric to justify the violence. And it was that narrative of racial difference that got us comfortable with 2.5 centuries of slavery. And the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude, it wasn't forced labor, it was this idea, this narrative that black people aren't as good as white people, that black people aren't fully human, black people aren't evolved, they can't do this, they can't do that. And that narrative created an ideology of white supremacy, and for me that was the true evil of American slavery. We passed the 13th Amendment that prohibits involuntary servitude and forced labor, but it doesn't say anything about ending this narrative of racial difference. And because of that, I don't think slavery ended in 1865. I think it evolved. After the Civil War, there were 100 years of terrorism and violence. Black people were pulled out of their homes, beaten, drowned, burned, tortured, and lynched. And the law did nothing. Communities did nothing. The nation did nothing. And then when we got to the Civil Rights Movement, we had this heroic moment. But that narrative of racial difference, this presumption of dangerousness and guilt continued past that era. And we're still burdened with it today. And so for me, talking about this became a real priority. And when I went to South Africa, I noticed in Johannesburg that they have an apartheid museum, that they have places that make sure that people don't forget the injustice created by apartheid. Outside the Constitutional Court in Johannesburg, there are symbols and monuments and memorials that talk about the wrongfulness of apartheid. I talked to people from Rwanda, and it was impressive to me that nobody in Rwanda wants anybody to come to that country and not be aware of the horrific genocide that took place. It is urgent that people who go there leave with an understanding of the heartbreaking tragedy that genocide created. They have a genocide museum in Kigali that actually has human skulls. That's how desperately they want to express their grief. I went to Berlin, Germany. And in Berlin, you can't go 200 meters without seeing markers and stones placed next to the homes of Jewish families that were abducted during the Holocaust. The Germans want you to go to the Holocaust Memorial. They're trying to change the narrative. They don't want to be thought of as Nazis and fascists. They want you to experience their regret and their shame. There are no Adolf Hitler statues in Germany. But in this country, we don't talk about slavery. We don't talk about the Native genocide. We don't have institutions that are dedicated and focused to making sure a new generation of Americans appreciates the wrongfulness of what we did when we allowed lynching to prevail and persist, what we did when we created racial apartheid through segregation. In the American South where I live, the landscape is littered with the iconography of the Confederacy. We actually celebrate the architects and defenders of enslavement.
Yeah, well,
and for me, that has to change if we're going to get to the kind of healthy place I think we need to get to.
So you want to change the narrative. That's why you're with a force behind the new National Memorial for Peace and Justice and the Legacy Museum. Many of our listeners are not familiar with these yet and haven't been able to travel to Montgomery to see them. So can you briefly describe each of them for us?
Yeah. So we created a museum that's a narrative museum. And when you come to our museum, first of all, it's located in a building that is the former site where a slave warehouse existed. And we want people to know that they're standing on ground where enslaved people were put in pens and held. And then it's a block from the auction space where enslaved people were taken to the square and sold. And it's a first-person experience. We actually went through hundreds of slave narratives and took these accounts, which are heartbreaking and devastating. And you come in and you see the visuals that you would see if you were enslaved going into a dark, a dungeon-like space. And we have these pens that are slave pens. And they look empty, but when you walk up to them, it triggers a motion sensor and a hologram will appear. And you'll see and hear an enslaved person who will give an account of how they were pulled away from their siblings, their parents, their children, how they were sold. And getting people closer
to the anguish and the suffering is part of what we're trying to do. And we enter the museum and you'll see slave auction books that advertise people for sale. You see the ads trying to recover people who have run away. And we go from slavery to lynching, and then from lynching to segregation. And then you go from the segregation era to the contemporary era. And we have a whole exhibit where you sit down and you pick up a phone and you talk to someone who is incarcerated in prison today. And we had our clients record their personal account of what it was like to be a 13-year-old sentenced to life without parole, what it was like to be innocent on death row.
You know, you're talking about trying to change the narrative of American history and make us remember and never forget the legacy of slavery and the post-Reconstruction era, the lynchings, all the injustices of that era. When you moved from the North to the South, and okay, you grew up in the South of Delaware, but you went to law school in New England at Harvard, then you moved to Atlanta and from there to Montgomery. In Atlanta and Montgomery, you saw, I'm sure, many monuments commemorating the Confederacy and the generals of the Confederacy. Tell us about some of the Confederate monuments that you saw and what the impact of seeing them was on you.
Well, I mean, obviously in the Deep South, there has been this whole effort to create a landscape that defends and romanticizes this period of enslavement and violence. When I moved to Montgomery, there were 59 markers and memorials in downtown Montgomery that talked unapologetically about the glory of the Confederacy, that era. Alabama, even today, still celebrates Jefferson Davis's birthday as a state holiday. A Confederate Memorial Day in Alabama is a state holiday. We do not have Martin Luther King Day in Alabama. We have Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. Our two largest high schools are Jefferson Davis High and Robert E. Lee High. They're both 98% black. And you're just kind of required to accept this cultural environment that is hostile to the history that black people have had to endure, that is indifferent to the violence and degradation that slavery represents. And I just think it creates an environment that causes people to be dishonest about who we are and what we've lived through. And it contributes to a lot of the problems that we are struggling to recover from today.
How do you think it contributes to the problem?
Well, if you don't have a consciousness of wrongdoing, if you don't actually have a sense of shame about these horrific human rights violations, you're not motivated to make sure that you don't replicate those things. I think that's what's different about present-day Germany. They have banned the swastika. They do not want anyone celebrating or glorifying what happened during that horrific period of the Holocaust. There's a commitment to making sure that every person understands what happened. Every school child in Germany has to go to the Holocaust Memorial. They teach it. They're trying to create a consciousness. And even that's not always enough. There's a growing movement of white nationalism there, but there's at least this investment. Most people in America know nothing about lynching. They know very little about slavery. We try to create these narratives that make it seem like slavery wasn't central to the Civil War. We try to romanticize this. And that's why today, when we have evidence of bias and discrimination, there's not a responsiveness to it that there needs to be. Until we reckon with history, we're not going to get free. I actually think we need an era of truth and justice in this country. We need to have truth and reconciliation. We need to have truth and restoration. And it's not because I want to punish America that I want to talk about these things. I actually want us to be liberated. I want us to get to a better place. I think there's something better waiting for us that we can't get to until we have the courage to talk honestly about our past. And there's very little evidence that we have done that in the United States.
If it's okay with you, I want to play a short excerpt of the interview we recorded in 2014 after the publication of your memoir, Just Mercy, which was adapted into a film. And this is a story that you told about when you were practicing at the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee. You'd been with the committee for about 4 years. You were a practicing lawyer. You were in your 20s, and you just moved into a new apartment in Atlanta, Georgia. You got home after a long day at work, and you were sitting in your car with the radio on, listening to the end of a recording by Sly and the Family Stone. As you were listening to your radio, waiting to go to your new apartment, a police car stops, and you didn't know why it had stopped until you realized the police were coming for you. And I want to play you telling the story of what happened.
Yeah, it was late at night. I'd been working actually on a case involving a young man who had been killed by police in Alabama. And I was just really enjoying the fact that my radio was playing. It didn't usually play. And I was listening to these songs sitting outside my apartment. And then the police car pulled up. And I was curious what they were looking for. And they shined the light on me. And I realized that, oh, they're here for me. And I got out of my car. I was going to explain to them that this is where I live. And before I could say a word, the police officer pulled a gun, pointed it at my head, and said, "Move, and I'll blow your head off." And I saw him standing there. His hands were shaking. I was terrified. And I had this moment of just crisis. And I put my hands up, and I began saying, "It's okay, it's all right, it's okay, it's all right." And I was completely confused. I had a moment where I thought, these aren't real police. They were actually Atlanta SWAT officers, which meant that they didn't wear the traditional police uniform. They were all dressed in black, black boots, black pants, black shirt. And he was just so menacing and threatening, and he kept saying, "Move and I'll blow your head off." And a second officer got out of the car, came behind my car, came up behind me, threw me on the back of the vehicle, and wouldn't let me reach in my wallet to get my driver's license to show that this is where I lived. And it just turned into this horrible ordeal where they kept me out there for 15 minutes. Neighbors were coming out. People were complaining about other burglaries in the neighborhood. They were asking the police to interrogate me about their missing items, you know, ask him if he has my vacuum cleaner, ask him if he took my cat. And it was sort of surreal and terrifying. One of the officers did a completely illegal search of the vehicle, went inside the car, started digging around, opened up the glove compartment. I had like bazooka bubble gum and M&M candies that he went through and then tossed aside. And I could never persuade them that I was there legitimately. And after they found nothing in the car and they confirmed that they didn't have a warrant for me, I asked them to apologize, and they wouldn't. The officer who left said, "You should be lucky you got away. Next time we'll get you."
You say in the book that your first impulse was to run.
No one had ever pointed a gun at me like that before. I was terrified. I just, you know, a kid growing up in the country, that was my first instinct. And I was, at that point, a lawyer who had done police misconduct and civil rights cases for several years. And so I knew to say, "It's all right, it's okay." But I had to take control of that situation and calm everybody down. And that's terrifying.
So let's just imagine for a second, if you weren't a lawyer, if you didn't have experience, if you hadn't thought a lot about what people do when confronted with the police that gets them into trouble, honestly, you might have been dead, right?
No question. And I, you know, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do a lot of things that people do. And if the officer had found something in my car, it would not have been legal or appropriate for me to be arrested or prosecuted under those circumstances. But that happens all the time as well. And then the narrative would have shifted, and no one would have had any sympathy for the fact that I was just sitting there minding my own business, trying to get into my own apartment. And I think the great burden for me from that experience was knowing that most of the kids in that neighborhood weren't prepared for that. And I was running around, you know, going up to strange young kids saying, "Do you know what to do when this happens? Are you ready?" And I was overwhelmed with this sense of fear and anxiety about whether kids were prepared to manage that and survive.
So that was Bryan Stevenson, recorded in 2014 after the publication of his memoir, Just Mercy. Bryan Stevenson, listening back to that now, I want you to connect that story to what we've been talking about during this interview today. We've been talking about how you can't just rely on the criminal justice system to change racial injustice in America. You have to change the narrative. This was the criminal justice system coming after you. It was the police coming after you, putting a gun to your head, threatening you for being on your block about to enter your own apartment. So connect this story to the larger issues that we've been talking about today.
Well, I think the first thing is I asked those police officers for an apology so I could feel better about what happened, so I could know that they weren't going to do this over and over and over again, that they had some consciousness that what they did was wrong. And the absence of that apology is what made it even more terrifying for me. It's what made me worry about what those police officers were going to do to other black men. And I do think it's why I feel so strongly that we have to have a bigger conversation than the conversations we have just in legal cases, just in litigation. We have to have a bigger conversation about what it's going to take to repair all of the damage that has been done by centuries of bigotry and bias. You know, in the 1950s and 60s, we thought we could just end blocking black people from voting. We could just end segregation and everything would be okay. The truth is we really needed to do something reparatory. We needed to repair the damage that that long history had created. And there's an urgency. I think too many people have been burdened for too long to stay silent a second longer. And that's what young people are saying when they go out into the streets, when people are killed, black people are killed, unarmed by the police. What they're saying is, we are so exhausted by this. The weight of this is too much. You know, I have to continue to navigate these presumptions of dangerousness and guilt. It still happens to me now. I went into a court not too long ago, right after I'd argued that case at the Supreme Court. I had my suit and tie on. I was sitting at defense counsel's table. The judge walked in, he saw me sitting there, and he got angry. He said, hey, you get back out there in the hallway. You wait until your lawyer gets here. And I had to stand up and apologize. I said, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't introduce myself. My name is Brian Stevenson. I am the lawyer. And the judge started laughing, and the prosecutor started laughing. I made myself laugh because I didn't want to disadvantage my client. My client came in. It was actually a young white kid I was representing. We did the hearing. But afterward, I was thinking, what is it when this judge saw a middle-aged black man in a suit and tie sitting at defense counsel, that it never occurred to him that's the lawyer. What that is the legacy of this narrative of racial difference, this presumption of dangerousness and guilt. And I'm now 60 years old, and I can tell you that when you have to constantly navigate these presumptions, when you can be a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer or a journalist, a student, be doing your best, not meaning harm to anybody, and still be presumed dangerous and guilty, I can tell you as I get older that it's exhausting. And I just want something better for people in this country. I want something different for the next generation.
So your memoir, Just Mercy, has been adapted into a film. Michael B. Jordan plays you. And Jamie Foxx plays your client who was on death row, and you succeeded in getting him out because he was unjustly convicted. How is it changing your life to have a movie adaptation of part of your life?
Well, it's surreal. I mean, I never imagined during all those years that one day there'd be a movie about that and somebody as spectacular as Michael B. Jordan or someone as talented as Jamie Foxx and Brie Larson and Rob Morgan would be bringing this story to life. But it's been really affirming. It's surreal, but I'm very excited. I'm very proud of the film. I think it gets it right. And Michael was so good. He wanted to get everything right. He was very committed to being authentic. And I was really honored by that. The one thing I told him he didn't have to be authentic about, I said, now you can keep that Black Panther Creed body when you play me. I won't have any objections if you look like that.
All right. Brian Stevenson, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air, and thank you so much for your work.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Brian Stevenson is the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, the Legacy Museum, and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which are all located in Montgomery, Alabama. The new movie, Just Mercy, is adapted from his memoir of the same name. The independent film The Assistant was inspired by the allegations of sexual assault against Harvey Weinstein that emerged in the fall of 2017. Written and directed by the Australian filmmaker Kitty Green, it stars Julia Garner as a young college graduate growing increasingly uncomfortable in her job working for a New York-based movie mogul. The movie opens in theaters this week after having just screened at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
I emerged from an early screening of The Assistant a few weeks ago to the news that a jury had been selected in Harvey Weinstein's rape trial. coming more than 2 years after the New York Times and the New Yorker first published their reports of sexual harassment and assault against the famed film producer, the headlines were a stark reminder of how long it can take for a wealthy and well-connected man to face the accusations against him in court, even after a stunning public downfall that helped give rise to the Me Too movement. Although it's not clear exactly when it's taking place, Kitty Green's quietly devastating movie returns us to a time before Me Too, and its explosive revelations of sexual abuse rattled the world, the entertainment industry in particular. The story unfolds over a single day in a New York film production office, run by a powerful mogul who is clearly modeled on Weinstein. But the character is never identified or seen. He looms menacingly large off-screen, invisible yet ever-present. Sometimes we hear his voice, booming yet muffled behind his office door. Sometimes we hear him barking on the phone at his overworked junior assistant, Jane, a college graduate who was hired just a few months ago. The actress Julia Garner, who won an Emmy for Ozark, plays Jane with piercing reserve. Whatever excitement she may have once felt at the chance to work for one of the film industry's most powerful figures seems to have abandoned her. Her workday begins early. It's still dark when she arrives at the office and starts making coffee and printing out box office reports. In the first sign that something might be amiss, we see her scrubbing a stain off the couch in her boss's office, then picking up a woman's earring off the floor. Her day gets busier from there. Her coworkers arrive, most of them youngish white men, who regard her with indifference at best and contempt at worst. The boss's wife calls several times, sounding irate and demanding to know where her husband is. He's catching a red-eye to Los Angeles that night, which means that Jane, the first to arrive at work, will also be the last to leave. You get the sense that no one wants to acknowledge the elephant in the room, but it clearly has something to do with the young women who drop by the office. One of them comes by to claim the lost earring. Another is being eyed as a candidate for an assistant job. As Jane learns, she's newly arrived from Idaho and is being put up by the boss at a fancy hotel in Manhattan. None of this comes as a shock to Jane. Everything we see happening seems to have happened before. But something about the young woman from Idaho, who couldn't seem more vulnerable or out of her element, causes something to snap inside Jane. Later in the day, she meets with someone in Human Resources. That's Matthew McFadyen, who plays Tom on HBO's Succession. He seems attentive and sympathetic at first, but Jane has trouble articulating her suspicions, and eventually he changes the subject.
What's your plan?
Sorry?
Where do you want to be in 5 to 10 years?
I want to produce. I want to be a producer.
You do?
Yeah.
That's excellent. We could use more women producers. You know, it's a tough job, but I can see that you've got what it takes.
Thanks.
So why are you in here trying to throw it all away over this bull?
Jane's conversation with HR is not just fruitless, but demoralizing. And in Garner's long pauses and terse replies, you can hear the seething frustration of a woman being condescended to and ignored. The assistant is Kitty Green's first narrative feature, but it feels of a piece with her earlier documentaries, Ukraine is Not a Brothel and Casting JonBenet, both of which address the exploitation of women. Her nonfiction experience may account for the cool, observational intelligence of her filmmaking here. The Assistant is one of the most soul-deadeningly realistic movies about office life I've seen recently, and I mean that in a good way. It's so vivid in its portrait of entry-level monotony that it could fill you with dread even if you didn't suspect what was really going on. Some might find the storytelling too oblique or frustrating in its deliberately limited perspective, but it's the rigorous understatement of The Assistant that makes it so powerful in its vision of how easily the Harvey Weinsteins of the world could exploit their absolute authority for years with little fear of consequence. Moment by moment, it pulls us into a world where predatory behavior is concealed behind closed doors, and the silence of a hushed workplace becomes its own kind of complicity.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. After years of being a devoted music fan and a regular at New York punk clubs in the late 70s, my guest Amy Rigby found her calling, writing songs, and singing them herself. She's great at writing prose, too. Her memoir, Girl to City, was described by our rock critic Ken Tucker as the best rock memoir he read in all of 2019. It explains how a Catholic schoolgirl from Pittsburgh became part of New York's punk scene and invented and reinvented herself as a performer and songwriter. It took a while before Rigby had the courage and confidence to stand on stage alone. She first performed in a band with her younger brother Michael called Last Roundup, which combined a punk and country sensibility and was described by some critics as cowpunk. From there, she sang with the all-women trio The Shams. By the time she made her first solo album, Diary of a Mod Housewife, she was 37. But it wasn't too late to be noticed. In 1996, that album was voted number 8 in the Village Voice's annual Music Critics poll. The housewife part of the album title refers to how she was already married and a mother when she made the album. And as she said, she decided she wasn't going to scrub the bathroom floor unless she could write a song about it. Let's start with a song that's a tribute to songs she loves. It's called Dancing with Joey Ramone.
He walked into the party looking just like he had in the past. He came up to me. I tried to say something, he said, girl, shut your mouth. You're praying Papa was a Rolling Stone. Last night, I was dancing with Joey Ramone. He was cool in his leather jacket and his little dark shades. He started dancing around, I tried to copy every move. Brushed me off, and they played Hanging on the Telephone. Last night, when I was dancing with Joey Ramone, they played The Worst That Could Happen by the Brooklyn Bridge. He hit me, and it felt like a kiss. Glide all over, needles and pens. Be my baby, again and again. Gloria, by the shadow.
Amy Rigby, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your memoir. I love that song, Dancing with Joey Ramone. You pay tribute to so many lyrics in that song. It's so much fun, and it's got such great energy. You came to New York from Pittsburgh, where you grew up. You came to New York to go to Parsons School of Design, and you planned on being a visual artist. But this was the era, it was the era of punk. It was the era of CBGBs. Describe what the punk scene was like then in New York and what the clubs were like.
There basically felt like there was two clubs, CBGBs and Max's, and downtown seemed to be where I felt comfortable, and that's where CBGBs was. And, you know, it was grungy, it was dirty, it was dark, everyone was smoking, it smelled of beer, and it felt like it was always either really, really hot or really, really cold in New York back then.
So you got married to a musician, Will Rigby, who was the drummer in the DBs. And I think soon after you got married, you got pregnant. And you were on the road. You were touring while you were pregnant. And then after your daughter was born, at some point you went back on the road occasionally. And, you know, you write that when your husband was on the road, it meant like, well, he was out like earning money. But when you were out on the road, you felt like really bad about it.
Well, I felt, well, at first I just took her with me. And that was pretty wacky because, you know, I was with the Shams and there were three of us girls. And then we'd bring a friend along to kind of keep an eye on my daughter while we were actually on stage. But we were in an unair-conditioned van. We had baby food jars floating in a beer cooler of, you know, just like melted ice, and just trying to get my daughter to go to sleep at night after a gig was really hard. She would be just so easy while it was all going on, but then she'd kind of react when all the excitement died down and we were all trying to go to sleep. But as things went on and, you know, she started going to preschool and stuff, it was hard. I couldn't really take her with me. I mean, I loved to go out and play, but I felt like I would miss stuff at home and that she needed me. And I just was trying to balance it as best I could.
After, I don't know how long, after a few years, your marriage was ending. And you wrote a song I really like about a relationship that is kind of looking like it's going to end, a relationship that's deteriorating, and nobody wants to be around you because they can all see the conflict and the trouble.
And the song, crazy.
Yeah, the song is called "When a Piece of the Sky Falls," and I'd like you to talk about writing this song.
It's a song that I completely forgot about until a few months ago. I was putting together a disc of demos that I recorded over the 80s and 90s when I was just learning to write songs and then eventually writing songs that would eventually turn into Diary of a Mod Housewife. But I completely forgot this song, and so I don't even really remember writing it. I just know that at the time I was thinking, well, if I can't have an artist career, maybe I could write songs for other artists in Nashville to record. And I kind of feel pretty sure that this was one of those that I thought, maybe I could find somebody. I was starting to send cassettes of songs down to publishers in Nashville and hoping, well, maybe Reba McEntire or the Judds, you know, maybe this could work for somebody like that. So that's what this song was about. But hearing it all these years later, I thought, wow, it feels so real and raw. And my own experience, I can kind of imagine that somebody probably wouldn't have wanted to record it.
Well, the song has an interesting angle because it's in part about people not wanting to be around this couple because the relationship has become so toxic.
Yes, I think it almost makes you feel a little bit like, ooh, uncomfortable.
Yes, which is what makes it so good. So let's hear "When a Piece of the Sky Falls." And this is from the companion CD that Amy Rigby has released, is a companion to her memoir, Girl to City.
The tongues are wagging, our hearts are dragging. Everybody knows we're all washed up. We've been so distant, so inconsistent. We made a mess of this love. People who see us all wanna flee us. They don't wanna get too close. Dissatisfaction, it could be catching. Nobody wants a dose. When a piece of the sky falls, everybody run for cover.
So that's a song from around 1994 by my guest Amy Rigby. It was a demo recording that she made. And now it's on an album of demo recordings that's released as a companion to her new memoir, Girl to City. The album is called A One-Way Ticket to My Life. So I love that song because it's about a deteriorating relationship. But you wrote another song called We're Stronger Than That. That's about a relationship that's kind of teetering. But, you know, the singer has faith that this relationship can stay together because, baby, we're stronger than that. It's such a nice contrast. How far apart did you write these two songs?
Probably within a year or even half a year of each other. And I think, you know, how I was just saying, when a piece of the sky falls, I felt sure it wasn't going to work for another artist because it had that discomfort. I think I purposely wrote We're Stronger Than That because I thought I should be more positive. And maybe if the song says that the people stay together, maybe it will work for me too. I think it, not just as a songwriter, but maybe you could pep talk yourself into keeping things together.
Did it work?
It didn't work. It didn't feel false. It felt, you know, because like you've said and we've talked about, I grew up Catholic, and it really felt like marriage meant forever.
So why don't we hear We're Stronger Than That, and this is from your solo album, your first solo album, Diary of a Maud Housewife. That's Maud, M-O-D.
When we made our vows to have and hold, we never thought about how love grows old. Well, even healthy trees run out of sap. Baby, we're stronger than that. And when I look at you, I see too much. I try to walk away when things get rough, but every time I do, I come right back. 'Cause baby, we're stronger than that. We're stronger than the fairy tales, diaper pails, lack of heat, urge to cheat, shattered hopes, tired jokes, Dr. Bills, urge to kill. And when we have another argument, you wonder where your feelings for me went. Well, even sugar peas run out of snap. Baby, we're stronger than that.
That was Amy Rigby, a song she wrote and recorded on her first solo album, Diary of a Maud Housewife, in 1996. So when your first solo album, Diary of a Maud Housewife, was released in 1996, you wrote a manifesto, a kind of manifesto to accompany it, and you reprint it in your new memoir. I'd like you to read it for us.
In the memoir, I left out the second half of it, but this is the gist of it. I've been a Maud housewife since 1993, when I decided I was not going to get down on my hands and knees and scrub the bathroom floor unless I could get up on stage and sing about it. I didn't want to fight about sex and laundry with my husband unless I could turn it into a song. Somehow, going to work at a crappy job made more sense if I could look at it as research. Oh, I'd played music for years, but that was with friends, for fun. This is different. This is about sanity.
What do you mean by this is about sanity?
I think by the time I was making Diary of a Maud Housewife, I was kind of just singing for my life. I just was so mixed up and wanted to do right by my daughter. I didn't want to end my marriage, but I just didn't know any way out that didn't involve like splitting up. So I guess I was in a way working it out through writing.
Did you feel like you were not only writing songs about, but trying to say that you can write songs about the kind of things that rock songs didn't exactly celebrate in the past, like songs about housework or songs with a diaper pail in the lyrics, or even songs about, like, not having sex?
Yeah, I mean, it was, even as a child or a young person, it was a revelation to me to read Irma Bombeck and to see that someone could be in a magazine talking about cleaning the kitchen sink. That really struck me and stayed with me. And again, in the 80s, Joyce Maynard had her column, Domestic Affairs, and Mary Cantwell wrote in Vogue about cooking her kitchen. And I thought, it's in like this national magazine, but you're allowed to talk about these humble, homey things that, you know, maybe in the past I would have thought, well, it doesn't have that much value as things like that men go out and do. So I really consciously wanted to talk about that stuff in songs, and in the same way that I read it in those writers' stuff. I thought it would resonate with somebody, and that somebody needed to do it and say that it was okay.
I want to play a song that you wrote called are we ever going to have sex again? this comes later. This comes, you recorded this in 2003. But it's a really funny song that I think a lot of people will probably relate to. And it's an example of something that could be very uncomfortable in real life. It makes for a very funny song. Tell us about writing it.
Well, the idea came from a friend in Nashville, Sherry Rich, and she, at that point, was married with a young child, younger than my daughter was at the time. And so she had the idea, the line, are we ever going to have sex again? And, you know, she kind of handed it off to me. I got some lines flowing, and we wrote this song. And it always seems to strike a nerve with people.
So this is Amy Rigby from her 2003 album, Till the Wheels Fall Off. And the song is, Are We Ever Gonna Have Sex Again?
Life's become a great big list of things to do and buy and fix. At night we pass out before 10. Are we ever gonna have sex again? I looked for your it today. Seemed that it had gone away. Ain't been used since who knows when. Are we ever gonna have sex again? We used to be triple X rated. Look at us now. So domesticated. Don't you hate it? To babe and stud, too much KFC and bud. I'll shout it out into the wind. Are we ever gonna have sex again?
That's Amy Rigby from her 2003 album, Till the Wheels Fall Off. Amy Rigby, thank you so much. It's just been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Amy Rigby's new memoir is called Girl to City.